Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear John, KC2 WGB, who handles our mailbag, among other functions. You'll hear Paul, WS2N, our space expert, a little bit later on. Occasionally you'll also hear Hal, K60PZ, who gives us the more brief answers. That involves quite a bit of experience with lots of ham radio equipment over the years. Main purpose of the technical net is education. We amateurs gather in the New York City area primarily on Sunday night, and we educate each other. We teach each other how all this hardware works. Antennas are not simple, and the way antennas are taught, the way the antennas are taught in our books is mediocre. The way the antennas are taught in our schools is, in my opinion, terrible. Very little useful engineering information is given in the instruction classes in our colleges on the subject of antennas. Lots and lots of improvement is required there. That curriculum was set in 1947, and they haven't changed it. And it needs a lot of change. So, we amateurs, if you really want an antenna engineer, you've got to hire a ham radio operator. That's almost a universal rule. Stand by a second. We teach each other how antennas work, transmission lines, propagation, transmitters, receivers, and the 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of those. We take check-ins during the first hour for purely ham radio-like questions most of the time. Occasionally we get into astronomy. But simple, it says here, questions and answers during the first hour. That's followed by our menu. Our second menu item is the mailbag. For people who don't yet have the ham license or don't have the right equipment so that they can sign into the TechNet live. The vast majority of what the TechNet does is a live interchange between ham radio operators. With rare exception, this is not a free consulting service that you're going to get in written form. There are people who would like to mail in questions and get a written answer. And there was one particular week, for instance, where John got 275 emails. John and I don't live long enough to even stand a chance of answering those questions. And sometimes the questions are poorly worded where you don't even know exactly what the person wants. In the case of a live two-way discussion, you very rapidly find out whether or not you've misunderstood what the guy said. And he said, no, I didn't mean that, I mean this. And it gets corrected. That's what the TechNet is. This is TechNet number 1,496 of the series of TechNets that began approximately September of 1982, 31 years ago. Let me drop. Way back then, N2FDJ and K2RIW thought we would answer some people's questions. We'd dry up and go away. We soon discovered there's a huge thirst for knowledge on radio. Again, because the books in the schools do such a poor job of teaching it. And because it's not an easy subject. An awful lot of what really takes place is not common sense. So, as I said, we thought in about a month we'd answer everyone's questions. Here we are 31 years later. There's always more questions to be asked, new techniques being developed, new ham radio operators joining. The total number of ham radio operators in the United States, for instance, is at an all-time high. Something like 713,000 licensed amateurs in the United States as we speak. From time to time, John and I hear people say, hey, what are we going to do about ham radio? It's going down the tubes. It's becoming just a hobby of white-haired people. Only the oldsters are doing it. The newsters are not interested in the subject. They're interested in computer games and the Internet, and they're not using ham radio. Lots of people have got that opinion. Well, you can have that opinion if you want. We're at an all-time high, and the rate is increasing. You take a look at some of the graphs of the rate at which ham radio operators are increasing. We're doing extremely well. There's something about this hobby, obviously. Let me drop. So you got to be careful about those kind of pessimistic opinions. I was told that there's a chat room with a huge, long URL that was given to us last week by, I guess it was Lou into NY2H. And now there is a tiny version of that to assign into the TechNet chat room. And John and others keep track of that. For the time being, I don't. But maybe I will someday. And the The chat room is on tinyurl.com/nytechnet. That stands for New York TechNet. So tinyurl.com/nytechnet. See if I got that one correct, John. KC2WGB for a correction. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, you do, Dick. That's the abbreviated one, present, and that's one with all those numbers. And by the way, W2BMP, Joe, has a committee chair, education chair announcement. He'd like to get in first, if you don't mind.
Yeah, very fine. I'm going to turn it over to Joe in a second. The real TechNet chat room is www.chatzy.com, followed by a 14-digit number. Very few of us are going to get that right without some transposition going on. So this smaller one is a hell of a lot handier. And so hope you were at the Hammerhammer flea market. It's not a flea market, no. Ham get-together today at the Levittown Hall. Joe, that is. Tell us a little bit of what it was like with your announcer. Whiskey 2, Baker Mike Papa.
Thanks, Dick. A couple of things. Number one, the Ham Fest was awesome. I think we had a record number of people, at least it seemed that way. My wife, W2CTG, was at the door taking everybody's money. The line was out the door. It looked like it was a success. The other thing I just wanted to comment on real quickly was I did a VE session. I was one of the VE examiners. And there's a lot of very young people taking their technical exam, and a lot of emergency people, firemen, ambulance, that kind of stuff, also going for the tech. So it looks like Ham is here to stay. Let's drop. And my announcement is I have two available seats for the general class. It's web-based, instructor-led. It starts tomorrow, 7 p.m., and I just wanted to let everybody know about the extra class, which starts April 1st. Also web-based, take it right from your computer or any mobile device. Instructor-led, starting on April 1st. Whiskey 2 Bravo, Mike Papa, thank you for the time.
Very fine, Joe. You told us it's web-based, you told us the time and the date, tomorrow. But I don't really know the address. I know it's web-based. Where do I go? What do I sign into? I imagine it's going to be on the limoc.org website. Give us a few words as to how a person signs in to this web-based class starting tomorrow. W2BMP, give us a little bit more audio, Joe. K2LAW, the second hand.
You have to register for the class, and you do that by either going to the Limoc website, to the education page. You'll see my email address there. Whiskey2BravoMyPapa@yahoo.com. I'll register once I get your email. I have two seats available. We have a maximum of 25 seats for any one class. So you have to email me first, and then I'll give you the link of where to go at 7 p.m.
Okay, Joe. Now you've told us where and when and how. Thank you. Good luck with that. With the VE session you had today, roughly how many people showed up for that VE session, and how well did it go, Joe? Go ahead, Joe.
We had about 20 people or so. A lot of technical, I'd say eight or 10 of them were just getting their tech license. Mostly they did very, very well. We only had two people who didn't make the tech. One guy took his tech, took his general, and took his extra. Made it almost to the extra and just didn't quite make it. But everybody did well. Again, I want to emphasize a lot of firemen, a lot of EMT, a lot of Red Cross. I'm seeing that in the class lineups as well. So a lot of emergency personnel realize the importance of ham radio in an emergency situation.
I can tell you're doing rather well there, Joe. 20 people roughly, and 18 passings. That's a 90% pass rate. You're doing something right. Keep it up, Joe. Alrighty. Now at this time, John and I will be taking check-ins. You're going to give me your listening, you need not sign in just because you're listening. What we're in the process of proving is that somebody out there on planet Earth is at this time interested in ham radio technical discussions and are not watching the Oscar Awards. I can't even think of the name of it, you know what I mean. Somebody is not watching that. They're actually doing some ham radio. Give me a call that is a name right now. K2LIW in the Tech Man.
Number 2, Echo Oscar, Richard, Massapequa Park, yes, and 2EO.
Done. Very good.
Okay, I heard Richard and 2EO, a double, and somebody who ended with Don. Don, give me your call letters.
W2OYY, Joe, yes.
KD2CXK, yes.
Okay, I got RYY, that's Joe. CXK, I should know your call letters. I mean, I should know your name. Tell me your name, sir.
I was testing you there, Deck. It's Craig.
And don't tell me you have something to do with astronomy. Okay. So we've got Rich, Joe, and Craig so far. Anyone else assigned into the TechNet? Is anyone else not watching the Academy Awards? Give me a call. That is a name right now. K2LIW.
I have a question. I was trying to look to that tiny URL that is slash TechNet and it's not working. It goes to freeweb.com, TechNet.
Working quickly, you mistyped.
Okay, Wes doubled with another person. Who was the other person who was signing in? After Rich, Joe, and Craig. Who was the other person? Give me a call with his name right now.
WS2N, Paul. With the space report, Dick. Good evening.
Okay, I heard Paul, and Paul doubled with somebody. Who was the other person checking in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KD2FQU, name is John.
Okay, John. KD2FDU, is that Foxtrot Delta Uniform? Is that correct there, John?
Foxtrot Quebec Uniform.
Foxtrot Quebec Uniform, okay. So we've got Rich, Joe, Craig, John. Anyone else? Give me your call letters right now.
Here's DPZ with quickie answers.
About Dow Key Relays, over.
Okay, somebody who said Dow Key Relays. Dow Key Relays, give me your full set of call and name, sir.
Ed, K2GJE.
Okay, we've got you, Ed. And we're going to talk about Dow Key Relays with you. Alrighty. Which was the first one? N2EO. How are things going in Massapequa Park tonight, Rich? N2EO, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Tech, everything is doing well in Massapequa Park. And I have a comment. You know, I think it was last week after the TechNet, I heard a bunch of guys talking. And what they were talking about, I mean, I do a lot of listening. I wasn't in the Q-cell, but what they were talking about was Voyager 1, Voyager 2, and one of them, or a group of them was saying, let me let it reset, that if some life force found Jupiter, Voyager 1 or Voyager 2, and play the hello commands and all the things that are on it. Now, a lot of people think it's going to be friendly, but who thinks it'll be friendly, they were saying. And it got me thinking, because if another life form could play it and possibly get here, who thinks they would be friendly? They might be not friendly. I wonder what you think of that, John. K2RIW and 2EO.
Okay, what you're about to hear, Rich, is a personal opinion, not necessarily the compendium of the other people in the United States or the world. I'm convinced that we're not alone. For us to have the arrogance to think that this is the planet going around the only sun that has life on it. That takes a lot of arrogance. By way of the Stanley Miller, Harold Urey experiment that done in 1956, we've got strong evidence that you can start off with the right raw materials under the right conditions, life will form every time. He did an experiment that strongly suggests that. You read his experiment and you can get the impression that if he waited long enough, life would crawl out of that test tube where he did that experiment, even though he started off with inert materials similar to what was on the Earth in the early days. So life is out there. The way any kind of life, like mankind, makes technological progress is to have curiosity. If you got curiosity, you're going to be looking at that anthill in the backyard, you're going to be studying the bees, the birds, the primates, and the other kinds of life in other places. Now, in the process of you developing the technology by which you can do something extremely difficult, let me drop it. By the way, by you to generate enough technology that you can do interstellar or interplanetary transportation, by definition, you've concentrated on real technical progress as opposed to warfare. You didn't just bomb each other out of existence, you and the other people on your planet, so to speak. So eventually you become a quasi-peaceful society. That's one reason why you wouldn't create foreign warfare. Another reason is that no matter what they've got, it doesn't have the value you think it has. Let's assume that now the closest thing that we can envision, the moon. Let's assume that the moon has the most valuable stuff that you can envision. I don't care if it's diamonds, platinum, gold, uranium, whatever you think is the most valuable stuff in the world. If the moon was chock full of it, it wouldn't do you any good. The Apollo program took $31 billion in 1968 money to send a few astronauts to the moon to pick up a few pounds of dirt and bring it back. $31 billion is what it cost in 1968 money. If you think you're going to mine the moon and bring the stuff back and get rich quick, I've got a bridge I want to sell you in Brooklyn. I own a piece of it. No way in hell. The stuff may be very valuable, but it's very hard to get to very far away. That's just a satellite going around this planet called moon. If I wanted to go to Mars to collect the valuable stuff, Mars is a million times more difficult to get to than the moon. How valuable would the stuff have to be on Mars that you're going to mine it? So if somebody thinks they're going to come here and do nasty things, give us grief, collect our valuables, or whatever, the chances of that being a reality are extremely slim. Because by the fact that they got here at all, they probably have ethics, and no matter what we got...
Repeater, time out.
And no matter what we got, it is so difficult to get to, so far away, and so expensive, it doesn't have anywhere near the value you think it does. It's a little bit like playing a chess game. By the time you move a piece all the way across the board, and it's attacking the other guy's components, you've made an investment in that piece to get him there. You've invested a whole bunch of moons, a whole bunch of moves. So he has more value than if he was back at the home plate, so to speak. Somewhere going on here. So I think we've got a lot of reason to believe that they're friendly, per se. And maybe occasionally they're going to be taking apart some of our cows and doing an experiment on them. But with their ethics, are they going to be doing us harm? Are they going to be collecting our valuables? I doubt it. I think it's a long shot. On top of that, although it was science fiction, remember the prime directive on Star Trek, leave them alone. Don't disturb them. Don't signal your presence because you might destabilize them, if you know what I mean. They think that they're the number one thing around and their God is the number one thing, so let them continue to believe that. Leave them alone. So for the most part, they have not made themselves obvious, not disturbed us, and let us run our planet the way we want to run it, with us using our stuff, if you know what I mean. Bunch of opinions, but at least you know where my opinions are coming from. And maybe other people have a similar opinion, Rich, so I wouldn't lose a whole lot of sleep about those extraterrestrials coming here and scaring the daylights out of you and taking your valuable stuff. I'm reasonably sure they're not going to take Colin's equipment. That's a little bit of a joke, Rich. N2EO, Colin's equipment collector, K2RIW.
KCXK with a comment.
KCXK with a comment.
Go ahead, Craig, with your comment.
Yes, if you're interested, Professor Michio Kaku is an acquaintance of mine, has a theory on all of what has just been discussed, and the category, he categorizes, intelligent species into many categories based on where they are evolutionary in energy manipulation. We are not even what would be referred to as a type 1 civilization. We're still a type 0 civilization, which means we get our fuel from dead plants and animals. But as you go up the chain and you're capable of, warping space-time, which allows you to get from one place to another within a normal lifespan, you've evolved past killing yourself off. There's a little hump there. I'll let it drop. So once you've done that, you've actually evolved past weapons and violence and all of this. So to make a long story short, if we're capable of going to another star, we've probably not killed each other off, which means we've evolved past violence. So that's something to look forward to. I hope that's a little bit of easement in everybody's nighttime. Oh, he also is thoroughly convinced, Professor Kaku, that is, that we've never been visited by anybody. He refers to us as nothing more than the ants under the microscope, completely uninteresting to anybody capable of getting here. KD2, CXK, back to net.
So is he under the comment?
West recognized. There's such a large number of sightings of objects in the sky that are very difficult to explain. You speak to any radar operator over the last 40 years, and they continuously see things on the screen they call angels. And they'd like to believe that these angels are some kind of a glitch in the radar screen. I kind of doubt it. My whole family has had an interesting sighting that took place at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday, and it lasted for 20 solid minutes. And for those 20 minutes, the three members of my family were passing the binoculars back and forth saying, look at those two objects in the sky. What in the world are they? What are they doing? Because they were sitting absolutely still. I know that they didn't appear on the FAA radar at MacArthur Airport, for instance. Let me drop. Even though the direction of observation from my backyard was in the direction of MacArthur Airport. So they were, in my opinion, very close to MacArthur Airport. But MacArthur Airport displays on their screen things that have that squawk back a particular IFF code and things that are moving. The screen is particularly tuned to not look at moving things because the non-moving things are ground reflections, what they call clutter. So these two objects sitting in the sky for 20 solid minutes, not absolutely moving. They weren't moving, they weren't showing up on the MTI radar, moving target indicator, and they weren't showing up because they weren't squawking a QRS, IFF code. So you can talk to a radar operator and say, did you see anything? And of course he'll say, no, I just saw the normal aircraft that particular day. So you can see how some of this can take place. And there's a whole series of other observations my family have made. The total number of things we've seen in the sky that are very difficult to explain is a fairly long list, as long as you've got the right kind of an open mind to know what you're looking at. I didn't say every one of the things I've seen are a foreign intelligence. My family has seen quite a number of things in the sky that are very difficult to explain. That's what I'm saying. And we haven't been invaded. And there's reason to believe that this has been going on for years. Mr. Makaku could think that we've never been visited. I think he's being overly pessimistic. I'm reasonably sure we have been visited. Wes, I wonder if you've ever seen anything in the sky that's difficult to explain. Intellect JN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, I was interested with the moon geological structure. Also, another comment is it difficult to mine moon? Well, the answer is that moon is part of the Earth that actually was started out when there was a collision of two planets. It's one of the theories. And everything that you have on the Earth, you have on the moon. Apart from that, you have plenty of very much strategic to the United States military, materials that are there. So the question is, why should we go for this 3.16 billion years old piece of rock. And why should we not? Do we have a diamond there? Well, according to the science, the processes that were on the Earth were over the Earth, the high pressure and everything. Yes, there is a plenty of gold, plenty of material there. So one of the possible explanations is they don't want to go there. It's not that it's expensive. The first microwave was $50,000 in the 50s, and that was like buying a $500,000 house. Now, the mission, I've read a very much interesting calculation. If that was that we become a semi-peaceful society, everybody else in the world, and all of the money will be redirected to a space programs that are spent on the militaries, the humanity would be able to send one spacecraft every day to the Mars. One spacecraft every day to the Mars. So, you know, it's just interesting how people could have so much different opinion. You have on the moon everything. Infrared, bauxite, oxygen in the silicas, calcium, aluminium. You have anything that you want there. They don't want to go there because they are afraid that if you bring too much of the goods in here on this Earth surface, you're going to corrupt the value. You don't want too much of the gold here because then if it's too much of the gold, it loses its value. So that's one of the possible reasons I can foresee. Enter here.
Hey,
very fine, Wes. Go ahead, Eric, K2EJ, K2RIW. How many things have you seen in the sky circling your towers, your broadcast towers? You got it, Eric.
No, I've never seen them circling broadcast towers, but I've been in the Midwest and seen things that couldn't be explained. But more interestingly enough, as time went on, talk about the astronauts. You can actually see some videos of James McGivitt from an encounter on Gemini 4 and Buzz Aldrin on Apollo 11. There's YouTube videos you can look at if you do a search for it. You come up with a whole bunch of stuff. I would stay away from the sites that are about UFOs, but the YouTube stuff is the best way to go because you're getting it directly from the astronauts. For years, they were essentially not allowed to talk about it, but in the later years of life, they said the heck with that, and they have had some really interesting discussions about it. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Yeah, you're making a very good point, Eric, and that is, in the case of astronauts, you're getting extremely well-qualified observers who have done a whole lot of flying with aircraft as well as spacecraft, and many of them have seen things. For a whole bunch of reasons of the previous controversy on the subject, NASA was instructing their personnel not to talk about it. But lots and lots of FAA pilots, astronauts and whatever, have seen things that are difficult to explain, and these things moved around in ways that do not look natural. They look like they're moving under an intelligence control of some kind. Arguably one of the biggest events that has ever occurred on planet Earth with reference to UFO encounters are the three, not one, three crash sites near Roswell, New Mexico in July of 1947. And lots and lots of hokey books have been written on the subject. One extremely good book has been written on the subject. The book is entitled Witness to Roswell, revised edition. It's $14 at Amazon.com. And this is two very dedicated investigative reporters. Let me drop. These two very dedicated investigative reporters spent each 20 years of their life interviewing the residents of Roswell, New Mexico. They interviewed 600 people over that 20-year period, 40-man-year period. And there's a commonality to all of their stories. that's very difficult to justify. And you listen to their stories of their deathbed declarations, and you hear, again, a common denominator, very difficult to explain as anything else other than a real crash of a craft that came from some other place. Of multiple incidents, but one of the sites was a great big gouge in the ground, 500 feet long, with the scorched earth around it. And you want to call that a weather balloon? Come on. That was the explanation given at the time, because we were scared to death in the middle of the Cold War that that was Russian material that had to be investigated, and they soon discovered it was not. So you read that particular book, you'll get an interesting point of view. And there's a lot of other reasonably well-written books. The fact is, there's a whole lot of hokey books and a whole lot of hokey descriptions by people who claim to have encounters. Some of them maybe were not valid. The fact that there's a lot of misinformation doesn't mean that every bit of the information is of zero value. That's a bunch of opinions. Okay, we're going to have to move on. That was Rich's question, and I wouldn't worry about that one, Rich. Joe was the next person on the question on the list, W-H-R-Y-Y. I bet you've got a more ham radio question to discuss tonight, Joe, K2RIW. You got it, Joe.
Who knows? Maybe there's another text net out there at this very moment being conducted by another smart individual. We never know. Yes, I actually do have a good question for you.
We're ready for that question, Joe.
Okay, this question has to do with antennas. Specifically, it has to do with Yagi type of beam antennas. And I'll give you an example. I use different antennas on the house for different various sources. And when I lost one antenna during a storm, I had to use a substitute, and the substitute didn't work anywhere near as well as the original one. I use a frequency approximately 438 megahertz for linking purposes. And when I lost that antenna, I had to use a substitute. Now, the substitute was tuned resonant-wise to be operating in that frequency range, but the performance of the antenna initially was a 450 to 470 antenna. It had two less antenna elements than the other antenna did, and it was slightly shorter in construction. When I got the other antenna back up on the roof, and, you know, repaired back up the roof, on the roof in place, I noticed a difference, quite a difference in the signal level between one to the other. And I just did a measurement earlier tonight just to confirm that with a signal generator. I could actually, you know, hit my equipment at the other end with a signal generator, and I can, you know, calibrate the level as far as what it hears for one level for one antenna or another antenna. There's a 6 decibel difference between the two antennas. The both antennas are being fed by LMR 400 line, so that's relatively low loss line at 450 megahertz. The line length is very similar, so the loss in the line should be very similar on each particular leg. They're both at very similar altitudes above the ground. So what's mystifying to me is one antenna initially is a 7-element antenna, and it's constructed to be 420 to 435 bandwidth. That's its normal operating range, even though I'm slightly out of it. The other antenna is a shorter antenna, and it's a 5-element antenna constructed to be in the range of 450 to 470. And I modified the driven element on the commercial antenna to resonate, to be resonant at 438 megahertz, which it does show if you check the return loss. I remember what you've always said to us, resonate then radiate. Well, it is resonating, but it's not radiating. Back to you, Dick.
All right, once again, Joe, you and I have something in common. I'm going to tell you my story, and you're going to see the relationship. Back in 1970, arguably the best Yagi design that anyone knew about was the Ed Tilton Yagi, W1HDQ, of ARRL. He's the creator of the world above 50 megacycle column in QST magazine. So Ed Tilton had a 13-element, very respected Yagi design. A buddy of mine in Long Island built 4 of them. They were up on his tower for about 4 years. He decided to take his tower down. I bought his 100-foot of row number 6 tower, and I bought those 4 Yagis. And if you take a look at the May issue, I think it's around 1978, QST magazine, there's an article by K2RIW and something called the Outdoor radiometry antenna range, an outdoor improvement technique. So I came up with this antenna range, which in my opinion is capable of making some very accurate gain measurements of Yagi-like antennas. Let me drop. And after I published that article on radiometry antenna range, it's interesting to note that it could be a coincidence, but the Rome Air Development Center in near Rome, New York, near Utica, New York, has arguably the world's best outdoor antenna range run by the Air Force, and they're using a radiometry antenna range. And I know something about that. So on this radiometry antenna range, I take these four identical-looking Yagis built by my good buddy, a microwave enthusiast on Long Island. He used to run a ham radio product company. Can't think of what it is right now. Anyhow, I bought these four Yagis and measured them. And I measured as much as 5 decibels of gain difference between the Yagis. And you look at the Yagis physically, measure them with your ruler, you measure all the element lengths and the element positions, everything was perfect. And by the way, in the case of a Yagi, getting impedance match of the driven element is step number one. Step number two is all the directors have to have the right resonant frequency and be in the right position in order for all the gain function of the Yagi to work. And here I've got four Yagis where the biggest spread between the highest and the lowest one of these Yagis that were about 4 years old was about 5 dB or 4 dB of difference. I couldn't figure out what's going on. Finally, I took an ohmmeter and measured the number of ohms between each element and the boom. Some of the elements had the 0.1 ohm difference of resistance between the element and the boom. Some of them were a complete open circuit. The elements went through the boom, and some of those elements clamped down to that boom with a horseshoe clamping mechanism. Tight as all hell. You couldn't wiggle the element. But when you measured the ohms between the element and the boom, it was infinity. The aluminum oxide had built up over the years, and that element had thoroughly broken contact, and it was no longer making contact to the boom where the element went through the boom. The boom itself is an inductive shunt on the center of each one of the
repeater. Time out.
The boom is an inductive shunt on the center of each one of those parasitic elements. As you break contact with the boom, each individual element gets tuned to a brand new frequency. And probably the worst condition is when the element is halfway between perfectly conducting and perfectly insulated. When it's halfway in between, and you've got, let me pick a number, a 10-ohm resistance between the element and the boom, you've now got a load resistor in the middle of each one of your directors, lowering the Q, tuning them to another frequency, and a loss element is there. So when elements go through a boom, and you've got more than, let's say, a 3 or 4 element Yagi, where the Q starts building up pretty fast, your elements have to be very carefully insulated from that boom. That's why the latest RIW Yagis have these Delrin black shoulder bushings where the element goes through the boom, thoroughly insulating the element from the boom so there can be no change. Correspondingly, one of the world's best antenna designers was Dr. Henry Jasek. I worked with him at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and he came to a conclusion as to what was the maximum gain you can get out of a Yagi-like structure when the elements go through the boom. And I'd come up with a Yagi, the so-called insulated Yagi, that was exceeding that number. And he thought I was making a measurement error. And yet those measurements were being done by Dr. Dick Turn of Bell Laboratories at an antenna range that was being set up at Trenton State College in New Jersey, and we thought we had traceability to the gain of those elements, to the bureau, so to speak, of those antennas. So each of the elements of a Yagi have to be built in such a way that they don't become detuned by local structures making and breaking aluminum oxide contacts. That's one very big factor. So impedance matching the driven element, let me drop. That brings you halfway home. But all those other directors have to each have the right resonant frequency and the right position in three-dimensional space for the gain to be there. So was there any evidence that you know of with those particular Yagis you're talking about where the elements have aluminum-to-aluminum contact, which is not a reliable contact because of the rate at which you build up aluminum oxide? Is there any doubt in the connectivity of your elements on your particular Yagi about the only way you can have elements going through the boom and being quasi-reliable is for each of those elements to have a perfect aluminum weld where each element goes through the boom, or have these bushings that thoroughly insulate them? And even the aluminum weld, I wouldn't trust it because I think it can build up a crack of aluminum oxide. W2LYY, K2LIW, Mesickna,
in a similar fashion. They both have elements going, I guess, through the boom, and they're both welded type of construction. But one is physically shorter in length than the other one. One is like a wide space yaki with seven elements. The other one is shorter space, much shorter space with only five elements. But there's a lot of difference. I'm noticing a 6 decibel difference in a radiated signal going out to a receiving device about 8-9 miles away. That seems to be a lot of difference.
Yeah, the fact that you're making the gain measurement over a long distance is another complicating factor, Joe. Assuming now that one Yagi has a larger number of elements than the other, and therefore one has a broader beamwidth than the other, that gives the broader beamwidth on one the ability to give a stronger signal to other adjacent objects. That signal 9 miles away is getting there by literally 1 billion path lengths. I'm not kidding. There's a billion different ways. You would like to believe that the main signal goes directly from your antenna to the other antenna 9 miles away, and maybe one signal bounces off the ground. You'd like to believe that. There's a million ways that the signal is bouncing at various intermediate points along the ground. Some of the signal is bouncing off of buildings, water towers, and trees, all kinds of other things. And a slight difference in the beam width of one versus the other gives a different amount of signal strength of that beam, of that bouncing object. Therefore, the possibility of a partial cancellation taking place, a null in the pattern, so to speak, at the receiving site when you use antenna A versus antenna B. Let me drop. The bottom line of all this is that if you want to really measure the gain of an antenna, you don't measure it over a 9 mile path. It sounds good. It is not. It may be the real world in the way you're going to use it, but that doesn't give you repeatable results traceable to the Bureau. You're going to set up a reflectometry antenna range, a ground reflection antenna range, a kind of antenna range where you anticipate the reflection off the ground and use it in your favor. The article on how to do that is written by Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU. It is hidden in the back of the ARRO antenna book under the subject of measurement technique. Is it measurement and transmission lines and measurements? I think it is. In the back of the chapter on transmission lines and measurements is this outdoor range improvement technique that uses ground reflection, a so-called reflective ground plane antenna range, which, by the way, Romair Development Center uses that when they get down to the frequencies below 1,000 megacycles. That great big range between two mountains that's 1.5 miles long, they stop using it, and they literally use the parking lot of their facility to make measurements of antenna gain and pattern below 1,000 megacycles. You use the intentional reflection characteristics in your favor. So that's the way you got to make the measurement. So as I see it, you've got a slight ambiguity, Joe, in the measurements you've made, and if there's any difference in the conductivity of the elements going through the boom, even if they're welded, you got to worry about that. And there are Yagis and there are Yagis. Let me drop. The fact that one Yagi has 12 elements and the other Yagi has 6 elements, and you'd like to believe the 12-element Yagi will always have higher gain. That's true if and only if the 12-element Yagi is a good design. In the case of usual elements that are relatively small in diameter compared to wavelength, some of the antenna modeling programs do a very good job. Those are not my favorite kind of Yagis. My favorite kind of Yagis are the ones that have very wide elements. And the bad news about those is they, although they give higher performance and greater bandwidth, they cannot be modeled by the usually available antenna modeling programs. So there are Yagi designs and there are Yagi designs. And so you're going to have to do a little bit more research to find out, did the guy build each one of those Yagis start off with a well-respected design? You start changing some of the element lengths and positions, and you can have a beautiful-looking Yagi as far as your eye is concerned, and RF performance-wise, it can be pretty bad. As you do further research on this one, Joe, I'd like you to come back and tell us what you discover, because you're in one of my favorite subjects. I'm one of those few guys that reinvented the Yagi antenna and re-patented it in 2004, roughly. I have a brand new patent on a Yagi where the original concept was invented way back in 1925. Over to you, Joe, W2RYY, K2LIW.
76, Dick.
Well, the question by itself was more or less a curiosity type of question. My equipment that I have connected, the one working Yagi that it's intended for, is working, and I'm going to sort of leave it that way. I brought up a sort of more of a curiosity type of question. I don't probably think that I'm really in the near future going to take both of them back off the roof and try to play with the stuff on the ground. It was more of a curiosity type of question, but I guess one antenna compared to another, if it has less elements, it's going to have a little less gain, but the gain difference I saw seemed to be not something I could really totally account for, but maybe what you said also makes some sense. I could be possibly transmitting in a null from one antenna to another antenna as far as the target is concerned 9 miles away. I didn't even think about that, but that's a very good possibility. Back to you.
DPZ with a comment.
Mr. Exxon with a question.
DPZ and West recognized, but first, Eric, very low audio, Eric, and I heard you say February 76. Maybe you're correcting me as to the date of the ratiometry antenna article in QST magazine. Is that what you're saying? It's really February 1976. KE2EJ, give us a little more audio. K2LIW.
Yeah, QSL, I'm reading it right now. It's in the archives. It's February 1976.
Okay, and do know that the February 1976 QST article by K2LIW on ratiometry antenna range, outdoor antenna improvement technique, outdoor antenna measurement improvement technique. Bear in mind that the original article was an article for the IEEE, Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, and the article got drastically cut down in order to be republished in QST, and some of the good information got eliminated, and some of the not so good information is left there, along with a great big crazy equation, which the average amateur is not going to be interested in. So if you really want the real information, go back to the original. The QST article, in my opinion, was edited in a way that's sort of mediocre. Bunch of opinions. Okay, you had a question about this one, Wes. boy, am I good tonight. Into XJN, K2LIW with your auxiliary question on Yagis.
DPZ is also in here.
I said I recognized you, and you're going to be right after Wes, because he signed in earlier. Go ahead, Wes.
Andrew, actually, kind of lost. Are you talking about rate of change in time frame? Because if nothing changes and you have a welded structure, it's going to work as a charm. If you have insulated between the elements of Yagi, it's going to do the same. When you bring the factor of the time change frame, so the change of the rate of change in the time frame, then the next question would be what about the dielectric constant? Because you have a weather condition and 5 minutes later you have different one. Would that affect the structure? Would that affect the gain? Enter a GM.
Good common sense, Wes, and the answer is absolutely no. A change in weather other than droplets of water sitting on the antenna has absolutely no effect on the gain of a VHF, UHF Yagi. However, because of the way the directors are operating, the ohmic resistance equivalent in the center of each element to the nearest number of milliohms makes a difference. If I could interrupt the center of a director, of a string of directors on a Yagi, and put a few milliohms of resistance in the center compared to ones that I didn't do that to, I would see a significant change in gain. A Yagi antenna is a weird mixture of things that are super sensitive and things that don't matter. I can take one director at a time on a 432 meg Yagi and move it 3 inches forward or 3 inches back, and very little takes place, very little change. Change the number of ohms in the center of that director by a few milliohms, and I'll measure a difference. Change the length of the element by a 16th of an inch, and I'll measure a significant difference. Change the chamfering on the tips of the individual directors so that they either are chamfered at a 45-degree angle or just a rough cut, and you'll measure a difference in performance. As I said, a Yagi is a weird mixture of things that are sensitive and not sensitive. Each individual director can be skewed out of plane so they're no longer parallel. And I tilt some of them to the left and tilt some of them to the right by 10 or 15 degrees. Nothing would change. I could make the ugliest looking Yagi in the world that has high performance. I can make the most beautiful looking Yagi in the world that has lousy performance. And side by side, you'll be thoroughly confused. It's a weird mixture. K60PZ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Hal.
Sorry, W, the technical K60PZ. Okay, this gentleman came on saying that he saw a difference in dBs between one Yagi and another. My question is, what was he using as a calibrated standard to measure this difference in dBs? If you take and want to make a measurement of difference in dBs, you don't go by an S meter. You go by an attenuator method and substitution method. I would like to know how he was making his measurements, because possibly his measurements are not made exactly right, and this is why he's seeing such a big difference in the dBs of one antenna to the other. Go ahead, Dick.
You make a good point, Hal, but I wasn't going to go there for a good reason. Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, has been around VHF, UHF repeaters for a whole lot of years. He's got a lot of experience. I don't think he fell into that particular trap. So let's turn it over to Joe for how he made these signal strength measurements. W-H-O-R-Y-Y, K-2-L-A-W.
All right, before I answer that question, which I'll answer very simply, there's a simple answer to that one. In closing out this question, since I'm taking a 450 to 470 commercial antenna, they're both commercially made. The 450 to 470 antenna is made by Sinclair, and it was made by RFS, which is another name for Solwave, okay? My closing part of this question is going to be, I can tune the driven element by looking at the return loss of that driven element with an antenna bridge. How do I do that with the directors? That'll be my closing part of the question. My answer directly to what this other guy just asked me is, I happen to own a lot of different test equipment. And the test equipment I used for this particular instance was an IFR 1500 service monitor with a calibrated dial on it that lets me tell it generate signals at 1 decibel increments or less per division. Does that answer your question? I radiated a signal in the air on one antenna cable and then another antenna cable, and I had to change the level of the generating from the IFR 1500 6 decibels plus in signal strength to make the signal arrive at the receiving point the same way as the original antenna. Does that answer your question?
It sure does, Joe. And I knew you were going to be able to give an answer like that. That's why I wasn't even going to go there. But Hal was knowing that other people listening could easily fall into some traps on this. When it comes to the signal strength meter on most receivers, you'd like to believe that it's following the calibration standard that was set a long time ago. S9 is supposed to be 50 microvolts. And each individual S unit is supposed to be 6.02 dB of difference. Half voltage on each S unit is the way it's supposed to be. No receiver you and I can buy, not even Collins, comes close to doing that. So you have to use other calibration techniques if you're using your receiver for doing a signal strength measurement by which you try to measure the gain of an antenna. Now, to answer your question, Joe, let me drop
a comment before we go any further.
In the case of a driven element, when you've adjusted the driven element so the reflection coefficient is near zero power, minus, let me pick a number, 15 dB, minus 20 dB, you have created a perfect impedance match to that driven element, and that's all that's required. By definition, the driven element now is resonant, is properly impedance matched to that particular transmission line, while the driven element is in the vicinity of the rest of those directors of that Yagi. Now, I'm being a bit of a scientist when I say that each one of the directors has to have the right resonant frequency in the right position. What I'm speaking is of a reality. However, to measure it will drive you up a wall. For you to find the exact resonant frequency of a director when you don't have a transmission line going to it, that is tough. In fact, because it's so tough, you don't. When you're tuning a Yagi for best gain, what you're doing is doing a perturbation technique. In other words, you've got your Yagi set up. Let me drop.
Can I make a fast comment before I get out of here?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I'm very familiar with the IFR 1500. We have one in our own lab. The dial is not always perfectly marked in dBs, the way that attenuator is designed. and you're telling me you use the attenuator on the 1500 to say your dB differences. I'm saying, if you run a cal on your attenuator with a substitution method to see how linear that attenuator is, I repair those 1500s. I've seen a lot of discrepancies.
Now, hold on, Hal. Let's assume that he's testing antenna A and antenna B at the exact same day, on the exact same setup, with the exact same IFR. He cranks the IFR dial clockwise while making antenna measurement A. He cranks the dial clockwise while measuring antenna B, and he sees 5 dB of difference on those dials. Are you going to tell me he shouldn't believe what he just measured, K6DPZ, K2RAW?
Because the dial hash marks don't fall in exactly. I've seen discrepancies. That's why I asked him if he had checked the attenuator with the substitution method, either at the other end of the receiver or coming out of the IFR into an RMS voltmeter, and it's a calibrated attenuator. I know what I'm saying too, Dick. You know, I work with these stupid instruments.
Hal, what you're now describing is absolute power gain calibration. Not necessarily relevant in this case. He's doing a relative measurement. Even if this particular dial happens to be 2 dB high, it was 2 dB high at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when he measured antenna A. It was 2 dB high at 3 o'clock in the afternoon when he measured antenna B. He used the exact same instrument, the exact same dial, twisted it clockwise, and made a relative measurement, and he measured 5 decibels of difference. Under those particular conditions, Hal, I want you to give me a rough assessment. How many decibels of error do you think he could have made when he measured 5 decibels of relative difference with that test procedure? K6DPZ, K2LIW.
Depending on how much level he was putting on the generator at that time, the linearity of that dial is not the greatest. That's all I'm trying to say, Dick. Because he's taking the hash marks and using that as his dB reference. And the accuracy is not that good on the hash marks.
Okay, you brought up another good point there, Hal, and that is almost any signal generator, no matter who makes it, when you twist the dial near the maximum, usually they have a waveguide beyond cutoff piston attenuator, and when you go from minimum attenuation, maximum power output, things start becoming nonlinear. Quite possibly, Joe was nowhere near that area. He may have been somewhere near the middle of the dial. W2LYY for a feedback on that. K2LAW, go ahead, Joe.
Waveguide below cutoff, by the way.
I was close to the top end of the dial, Dick, not the bottom end of the dial, because it took quite a bit of signal strength, just a little below 0 dBm, to get a signal out of the antenna to hit the receiving site 9 miles away. But let me just make a comment in general about the attenuation in any particular service monitors. I own 2 of them. And the attenuators are calibrated with the dial face per attenuator. It's not that the dial face is placed on a attenuator. You can't take one dial face and put it on another attenuator. And I know that because I talked to the technician directly at IFR out in Wichita, Kansas, where they repair these things. And he said each one is calibrated individually as they are manufactured. And they're originally manufactured from wedge cell attenuators. That's who made the attenuators for IFR. So the dials are probably pretty good. They say in the book, plus or minus 2 dB accuracy, that's a worst case across the entire face of the dial from 0 to minus 127. But if you look at any point of the dial, they'll hold within about 1 dB or so if you go from one change to another. And you go a couple of dB up, a couple of dB down. If you want to verify that with power meter, go ahead. I've done it online already. But that's how these things work, because I've already been that way with them, speaking about it, for that exact subject. Back to you.
Talking about using power meter, I was talking about using the Boot 92B RMS voltmeter. Either way, one is, I found more accurate than the other. Well, I'm just saying, in experiences I had with these attenuators on the 1500, I've seen discrepancies.